This morning, America's First News starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to GEICO.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning with your host, Gordon Deal.
How should we handle North Korea? Good morning. I'm Mike Gavin in for Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. It's Thursday, July 6, 2017, and here's what we have for you this hour.
Ahead of the G20 summit, President Trump says North Korea is behaving dangerously and that something will have to be done about them in light of the country's July 4th missile test.
Wounded Congressman Steve Scalise has been sent back to the intensive care unit after new concerns over an infection.
A magnitude 5.8 earthquake rattled Montana residents this morning, knocking items off shelves and even knocking out power for a short time.
And how the growing legion of big city cyclists can stay safe on the road.
A lot of that is led by bike share programs, which have just exploded. There's more than 50 programs nationwide now, mostly centered in cities where people can rent a bike just for the day or for the hour.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman with new research on how cyclists can avoid accidents. She'll have more in about 20 minutes. The U.S. and Russia clashed at the United Nations Security Council over how to respond to North Korea's nuclear weapons program. The standoff between diplomats on Wednesday came just 2 days before President Donald Trump and Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin planned to hold their first meeting during the G20 summit in Germany, raising the stakes for both leaders as well as China, which will also attend the international gathering. All this follows North Korea's July 4th launch of its first intercontinental ballistic missile, deemed by U.S. officials to be capable of reaching Alaska. U.S. officials invoked direct threats of military action. At the U.N., U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley warned diplomats that time is short for diplomatic action and said the Trump administration would be willing to use military force if punitive restrictions fail to deter North Korea from its plans to perfect a weapon that can strike the U.S.
One of our capabilities lies with our considerable military forces. We will use them if we must.
However, Russia and China formed a united front against the U.S. and its allies, saying they would strongly oppose new sanctions or military action and offered a joint plan that called for dialogue and a halt in military operations and exercises by all parties, including the U.S., in the Korean Peninsula. Both Russia and China have veto power as permanent members of the Security Council and hold considerable sway over North Korea. Ms. Haley fired back, indicating the U.S. would be willing to put the resolution to a vote, even in the absence of a consensus. The condition of Congressman Steve Scalise has worsened. We get more from this morning's Dave Duncan.
According to the MedStar Washington Hospital Center, Congressman Scalise, who was shot and wounded during a congressional baseball practice last month, has developed an infection and has re-entered the intensive care unit. Scalise is the number three Republican leader in the House and had been improving in recent weeks following numerous surgeries to repair internal organs and broken bones. He was shot by a man named James Hodgkinson, who had a history of posting angry messages against President Donald Trump. The gunman died after being wounded by police at the Alexandria, Virginia ball field. Mike.
All right. Thanks, Dave. The hospital has also downgraded the congressman's condition from fair to serious and has said it would provide another update later today. Senate Republican leaders, in a bid to salvage their health care overhaul, are weighing the merits of a proposal by Texas Senator Ted Cruz to let insurers that sell plans that conform to the Affordable Care Act's regulations also sell policies that don't. The idea, also backed by Senator Mike Lee of Utah, would allow insurers to offer cheaper, less comprehensive policies likely to be bought by healthier people. Those policies could charge higher prices to those with pre-existing medical conditions and possibly deny them coverage altogether. Senator Cruz spoke at a forum on veterans' health in McKinney, Texas, last night.
The single most biggest reason people are unhappy with Obamacare is they can't afford health insurance premiums. I hear that every single day as I travel Texas.
Meanwhile, protesters unhappy with the current Senate health care proposal demonstrated outside of the event.
I need to protest what they're doing in Congress and to take our health care away from us instead of fixing something that's already in place.
The Wall Street Journal says that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has asked the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office to analyze the cruise provision's impact on the federal budget and on insurance coverage. Assigned Senate leaders are genuinely contemplating it. Outside conservative groups such as Club for Growth and Freedom Works, which are pushing for a full repeal of the ACA, say the cruise measure would get them at least a step closer to their goal. The White House has also backed Mr. Cruz's proposal. The House would have to approve any bill the Senate passes for it to become law, and conservative House Republicans, who almost foiled the party's effort to pass a bill in May, also say the cruise provisions could be essential to getting their support. 11 minutes after the hour now on This Morning, America's First News.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Gordon's off. I'm Mike Gavin, taking you through a Thursday. Republican senators are confronting a political challenge that is increasingly hard to ignore as they engage with voters in the weeks and months ahead. Under their health care overhaul, average premiums for a mid-level insurance plan would jump sharply next January. Looking at the calendar, WSJ healthcare policy reporter Stephanie Armour says that means many people who don't get insurance through work would see their premiums increase just a few months before the midterm elections. Stephanie joins us now. Stephanie, what did you look at here?
One of the big issues for Republicans is that they want to get a health care bill passed, but the health care bill that the Senate is currently looking at would increase premiums by 20% in 2018, according to a recent report from the Congressional Budget Office. And the problem is that you would have those premium increases start in January, and you'd have 9 months of people paying those higher costs before the election. So the concern is that in the midterm elections, Republicans could be stung by voters who are seeing those higher costs. Some of the premiums do come down later, but not before the midterm elections.
How are they going to campaign with that?
That is a very good question. I don't think it's so much a campaign issue at this point as they're trying to decide what to do, because the other option that certainly could occur is that nothing is done, that they are unable to come up with a repeal bill. That is sort of their worst-case scenario. The question is, how would that potentially also affect them at the midterm elections? Because if they don't do anything, they are concerned that their constituents would feel they didn't deliver on their promise.
Not that we like to shirk personal responsibility, but what about the strategy of blaming Democrats, saying there's a list of things we wanted to do and they blocked us at every turn or something like that?
Well, that's going to be a tougher one for them on this one, because the rules that they're using to pass a health overhaul bill doesn't need any Democrats to vote for it. So they're able to do this simply on their own, but they do need to get they can only afford to lose two Republicans on the Senate side for this to pass. So their ability to blame Democrats for blocking them is going to be harder, but they are very much trying to say, look, Democrats are not working with us. They're not coming to the table to talk about potential bipartisan options or ways forward on a bill. So that is definitely a message that they're trying to hammer home even now, and my guess is that would accelerate before the preterm elections.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal healthcare policy reporter Stephanie Armour. She's written a piece entitled GOP Senators Weigh Higher Health Premiums' Possible Effect on Midterms. Talking about the long-term benefits, is that not a good campaign argument?
The Senate bill, it would bring down many premium prices starting in 2020, although premiums for people who are older or have pre-existing conditions are likely to increase because states could get waivers. It's kind of a complicated process, but how people are affected would very much depend on kind of their age, their health status, but for a large number of people, they would see premium prices come down. For unfortunately, this could also be an issue in the 2020 election, because they would come down for plans that are less robust in terms of what they cover, and out-of-pocket costs would increase.
So does the rock in a hard place here for Republicans mean advantage for Democrats, or not necessarily, because many of them have admitted that there are problems with Obamacare?
I think the advantage to Democrats, quite frankly, would be if something goes through or something happens that does not work well, Democrats are definitely hoping to get to a single-payer system. And there are some people saying that if something goes through that deprives a lot of people of coverage or drives up costs, that that could provide a platform for Democrats to retake the chambers and potentially push through single payer, which is, of course, Republicans' worst fear and one of the things they're bringing up to try and get members on board.
All right. Thanks very much, Stephanie. Wall Street Journal healthcare policy reporter Stephanie Armour joining us this morning. It's 20 minutes after the hour now. Jennifer Koshenka has returned with more of America's First News.
Like President Trump says he agrees that Russia meddled in the presidential election, but he repeated his assertion that he believes other countries may have done the same.
It was Russia, and I think it was probably others also, and that's been going on for a long period of time. But my big question is, why did Obama do nothing about it?
Trump did not elaborate on which other countries he believes meddled in the election during his remarks in Poland today. He says nobody really knows for sure. He was speaking a day ahead of his first face-to-face meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. An earthquake strong enough to rouse sleeping residents more than 30 miles from its epicenter struck western Montana early today. Robert Sanders, a geophysicist with the U.S. Geological Survey, says a magnitude 5.8 earthquake hit just after midnight about 6 miles southeast of Lincoln.
General seismic activity in this part of western Montana is not rare, but quakes of this magnitude have been extremely rare in the past. We had a 5.6 about 100 miles south of this earthquake in 2005.
There were no immediate reports of injuries or damage. Despite North Korea's claim its intercontinental ballistic missile launch shows it can attack targets anywhere at once, experts say it will probably be years before it could be in use and such a weapon in a real-world scenario. The test on Tuesday demonstrated the North is closer than ever before to reaching its final goal of developing a credible nuclear deterrent to what it sees as the hostile policy of its archenemies in Washington. But even for an experienced superpower, getting an ICBM to work reliably can take a decade. NPR marked the 4th of July by tweeting the entire Declaration of Independence, but it seems some Twitter users didn't recognize what they were reading. Some of the founders' criticisms of King George III were met with angry responses from supporters of President Trump, who seemed to believe the tweets were a reference to Trump's presidency. NPR says the tweets were shared by thousands of people and generated a lively conversation.
Putting it diplomatically, a lively conversation. It just shows how quick we are to just be angry about everything now. And that goes for both sides now.
And how perhaps we should study history a little more in school.
That would also be a good thing as well. Thanks very much, Jen. 22 minutes after the hour now on This Morning, America's First News. Coming up next, how to keep cyclists out of accidents. Well, believe it or not, some of the best ways to make bicycle riders more visible to drivers and hopefully safer are also the simplest. That's according to new research highlighted by Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, who joins us now. Rachel, one of the reasons that we're talking about bike safety is that there's been an explosion in bike ridership, especially in cities over the past decade, right?
A lot of that is led by bike share programs, which have just exploded. There's more than 50 programs nationwide now, mostly centered in cities where people can rent a bike just for the day or for the hour.
So your piece sort of centered around the different research that's being done to try and keep bicyclists in cities more safe. One of them involves the motion of the pedaling. What was that all about?
Yes, this is a sort of a joint venture between Trek Bicycle and Clemson University. And what they found was essentially the importance of highlighting what they call biomotion of cyclists to make cyclists more identifiable as cyclists to those around them. Because, you know, if you're a driver and you're looking at a city landscape, there's a lot of clutter, right? There's road signs, there's other cars, there's pedestrians and so on. But what they found was really effective to making cyclists apparent as cyclists is highlighting the cycling motion. So things like neon, shoes or socks, something that highlights the pedaling motion, which people recognize instinctively as human. Also, lights on the backs of ankles. They sort of rigged these up. These do exist, but Trek actually does not make them. On the backs of cyclists' ankles, and they found that people spotted those really far away because they recognize that pedaling motion.
Now, what about the role of bright or fluorescent clothing? That was kind of a mixed bag in the research, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Bright or fluorescent clothing.
Yes, that's a good question. Number one, I think people overestimate how visible they are in fluorescent clothing at night, so it's not very effective at night. But during the daytime, it can be helpful to wear, for instance, a fluorescent jacket, but much more helpful is, again, to wear fluorescent colors on your legs to make them more visible, you know, fluorescent leggings or some kind of markings, or sometimes there's these little bands you can attach to your ankles to just highlight the pedaling motion. That's really the key.
Now, what about, you did mention a little bit about lights and about the lights on the back of the ankles. What about lights sort of on the front and the back of your bike if you're riding at night?
Yes, at nighttime, it's very important. Most states actually have a law that you have to have at least one light, if not two, usually a white spotlight on the front and a red taillight on the back, oftentimes blinking. That really draws attention. And in some places, in fact, in a couple of bike shares in New York and London, they're testing out something called laser light, which actually mounts to the front of the bike, and it projects a laser image of a bicycle about 20 feet in front of the bike. And the purpose of this is to warn crossing traffic and pedestrians and so on that a cyclist is coming. And they find that this makes bikes much more visible in the dark.
In general, actually, the odds that you're going to be in an accident on your bike are actually going down, though, aren't they?
Yes, that's what the data suggests, especially from big cities. And one of the theories is that, you know, one, the bike infrastructure is improving, and two, there is somewhat of a strength in numbers.
All right. Thanks very much, Rachel. Some good info as always. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. 30 minutes after the hour now on This Morning, America's First News.
When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org.
America's First News is online all the time. Follow us on Twitter at This Morning Show, like us on Facebook, or send us an email thismorning@compassmedianetworks.com.
34 minutes after the hour, Mike Gavin sitting in for Gordon Deal on this Thursday, July 6th. Here's some of the stories we're keeping an eye on for you this morning. President Trump in Poland before heading to the G20 summit and a meeting with Vladimir Putin says that nobody knows if Russia meddled in the U.S. election. An emotional vigil is held to mourn the NYPD officer murdered early Wednesday morning. An early morning earthquake rattles residents and knocks out power in Montana. United Airlines is being criticized again, this time for giving away a two-year-old seat to a standby passenger. And if you're getting ready for the zombie apocalypse, there's a summer camp for you. More on that in 20 minutes. This business update is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org today. Well, Bitcoin was designed to be cheap, reliable, and fast. Lately, though, many users are complaining that the digital currency is anything but. The cost for investors and consumers to buy or sell Bitcoin hit an average of $5 per transaction in early June, the highest rate of its 8-year history as an alternative means of payment. Here to explain is Wall Street Journal markets reporter Paul Vigna. Paul, why don't you back up for a second and explain virtual currency and Bitcoin?
Essentially, what these are digitized assets. The real innovation of them isn't so much that they are digital. I mean, because essentially the dollar can operate in much the same way, right? If you use a credit card, you're spending money over an electronic network. The real difference is that these are stateless currencies. They're designed to be run. They're designed to operate via a software program that runs across a network of computers that no one central entity controls. And that sounds awkward and gawky description of it, but that's essentially what it is. And what that allows people to do is exchange money. You know, we're calling it money. Exchange money directly between two individuals, between you and me, without a bank or a state government in the middle sort of, you know, overseeing that process.
Yeah.
That's essentially what is going on.
So the issue these days seems to be the fees associated with transactions.
Yeah, it's definitely one issue, and it's an outgrowth of what's going on in Bitcoin right now, which is this big fight over how to expand network capacity. And they're at a real stalemate over how to do that, the different groups within the industry. And what has happened is, because they have not been able to come up with a way to expand the capacity, Bitcoin can handle about 7 transactions a second right now. So because they have not been able to come to a consensus on how to do that, the capacity has remained stagnant. It hasn't moved, but the number of transactions going through the network has increased over the last 6 months, over the last year, because Bitcoin is getting more activity, more people are coming to it. A lot of that is just trading, but some of that is people trying to use it for small, you know, sort of day-to-day, daily purchases. And what's happened is you've had this bottleneck, and the issue of transaction fees has become acute. But with the bottlenecks, what's happening is these systems are automatically designed to offer more money to do that. So what's happening is it's becoming a supply-demand market, and the demand to get your transaction through is meeting up with limited supply, so the prices are going up.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal markets reporter Paul Vigna. He's written a piece titled, "Why You Won't Be Buying a Coffee with Bitcoin Anytime Soon." Is it possible, Paul, that transactions still go through for free? Like if I said, Paul, just wait 3 days, I'll give you the $10 I owe you?
Yes, that happens. And I should stress, too, that this is not necessarily a permanent circumstance. You know, like I said, they are the industry is trying to figure out how to increase capacity. And if they can come to a way to do that that everyone agrees upon and they move it, then these fees should come back down. And that is certainly the goal.
Okay.
But right now, at this point in time, because of this stalemate in this debate over how to scale it, the fees have gone up, and it's not a Bitcoin killer, but it's a problem.
Do you see Bitcoin continuing to grow in use?
Me personally, do I see that? Yeah, I do. I do. I don't know that it's going to become anytime soon, you know, the sort of take over the world product that people had thought it was going to be a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
But I do think what has happened is you have had a steady growth in sort of the adoption of it. And I do think that's going to continue.
All right. Thanks, Paul, for trying to explain that to those of us who are a little bit Bitcoin challenged. Wall Street Journal markets reporter Paul Vigna. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Well, when Emmy nominations are announced a week from today, music supervisors will be competing for the first time ever after being granted an award category of their own. But long before the September 17th awards ceremony, supervisors are wondering how Emmy voters will evaluate excellence for a job that is more subtle and complicated than it sounds, selecting the soundtrack for scenes in TV shows. More now from our own Gordon Deal.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal entertainment writer John Juergensen. He's written a piece called Peak TV's New Hot Profession, the music supervisor. All right, so what's up here?
Well, it's almost like, you know, when you're watching TV, or at least with certain shows, it's almost like you're listening to the radio at the same time, with, you know, songs coming in that really play a big part in the action that's on the screen and the characters that are on the screen too. It's a job in the TV world that's become a lot more important in the last decade or so. The people who pick these soundtracks for the shows, and they're finally getting some probably long-delayed recognition in the form of an Emmy for music supervision. That's the first time they're going to be in contention for an Emmy Award for this job.
Wow. I didn't even know this type of job existed. Oh, I guess it kind of had to imagine.
Sounds like a dream job, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I get to basically play human jukebox, right, and pick songs to play in TV shows.
Yeah.
You know, these are folks who often maybe come from the DJ world, and they, you know, have a pretty deep knowledge of music, but I mean that's half the job, you know, figuring out what songs to insert for the perfect moment on TV. And these are pre-existing songs. These people aren't composing songs. Mm-hmm. They're choosing songs by anyone from, you know, Pink Floyd to some artist that just came up on the internet.
Yeah.
So their job is to find the right song, but then they have to go through the big hassle of clearing the song, that is licensing it for TV, which, you know, is half the battle.
Yeah. All right. So give some examples. You mentioned a couple, obviously, in your piece.
A lot of shows kept popping up as kind of really great shows for music lovers, shows where you're going to hear unexpected stuff. You're going to discover songs that an artist that you've never heard of before. So Fargo, that FX TV series based on the Coen Brothers film, that's one that has been coming up a lot among people who like music on TV. Mm-hmm. The show Master of None, the Netflix series created by Aziz Ansari. I know he's got a big role in the music, but the music supervisor on that show, too, comes up with some interesting choices, anything from sort of old Italian pop music to, you know, music from the 80s that you might have forgotten. The Leftovers on HBO, that was also cited by a lot of people as having some really strong music. And you have some of the more conventional choices, you know, like Empire, that Fox TV series has, you know, just packed with hip-hop songs and also original songs. So there's different kinds of styles, too, you know, in keeping with the show.
That clearing has to be a pain in the neck.
Yeah, just for, 20 seconds. I mean, it almost doesn't really matter how long you're using the song in the show. You know, it'd be something you hear just fleetingly on a car stereo or something like that. Right. But, you know, they still have to go through all the hurdles to get these songs licensed. And, you know, there's two different things they need to secure. They need to get the sound recording itself, and then there's the separate rights for publishing, the written composition. And those rights can be held by many different people. And they can also be people who are no longer in the music business, especially if it's an old song or an obscure song, or if it's a hip-hop song, which often has ownership in the form of lots of different people. So, you know, it can be a real task just to even find the folks who own the rights to these songs. And then you got to go through the process of, you know, haggling and negotiating prices and usages and things like that. So, yeah, it's a lot of legwork for just to get, you know, one or two of these songs into a show.
The Leftovers, Fargo, Master of None, all great shows with great music. That's Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen with our own Gordon Deal. It's about 13 minutes in front of the hour now on This Morning. Jennifer Kashenka has returned with more of America's First News.
Like President Trump says he's considering some very severe things to respond to North Korea's test launch of an intercontinental ballistic missile. But he adds that that doesn't mean he's going to follow through on them.
There are consequences for their very, very bad behavior.
Trump says he wants to look at what happens over the coming weeks and months and calls North Korea's behavior a shame. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Russia clashed at the U.N. Security Council yesterday over how to respond to North Korea's nuclear weapons program. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley warned diplomats the time is short for diplomatic action.
One of our capabilities lies with our considerable military forces. We will use them if we must.
Pentagon officials describe North Korea's potential weapon as a new kind of missile they haven't seen launched from there before. Russian President Vladimir Putin is assailing politically motivated sanctions as a hidden form of trade protectionism ahead of the G20 summit in Germany. Putin says sanctions on investment, trade, and technology transfer not only lead nowhere but contradict the G20 principles of working together. The European Union and U.S. have imposed sanctions on Russia over its actions in Ukraine. Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise, shot and wounded during a baseball practice last month, has developed an infection and has been readmitted to an intensive care unit. The number three Republican leader in the House had been improving in recent weeks following surgeries to repair internal organs and broken bones. The arts and crafts chain Hobby Lobby will pay $3 million to settle a federal case over smuggled Iraqi antiquities it bought to demonstrate its passion for the Bible. The Oklahoma-based retailer also agreed to forfeit thousands of clay artifacts it bought in 2010, an acquisition the prosecutors say was fraught with red flags the company didn't heed. In a statement, Hobby Lobby President Steve Green acknowledged regrettable mistakes that he chalked up to inexperience. A huge ice sheet, more than seven times the size of New York City, could be about to break off from Antarctica. If it breaks free, it'll be one of the world's biggest ever icebergs, measuring 2,300 square miles. The ice crack currently spans 200 kilometers, leaving just 5 kilometers of connection left. If it drifts away, there are fears it could pose a danger to ships.
Yikes. That makes the Titanic iceberg look like kind of a speck of dust.
Yeah, really.
Like an ice
cube, yeah.
Oh, boy. Thanks very much, Jen. Coming up next, how to prepare prepare for the coming zombie apocalypse.
Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today.
Well, it's officially summer camp season, and among the sea of day camps, theater camps, and karate camps out there, there's one camp that's looking to stand out. According to USA Today, Original Zombie Survival Camp, located in the Pine Barrens section of southern New Jersey, offers day and weekend camps featuring trainers with diverse backgrounds, including the military, martial arts, firearms, personal training, and mechanics. Adult and teen students learn practical life skills, including first aid, hand-to-hand combat, how to shoot guns and crossbows, how to throw a knife, how to start a fire, how to find a clean source of water. The camp is run by husband and wife Mark and Sue Skelsa. Sue is a compliance officer for an insurance company during the week, which she says is a lot like preparing for a zombie apocalypse. After work, she specializes in crossbow training at the camp. As you might imagine, lots of fans of The Walking Dead have participated in the camp. Mark said that he and his wife are really running a survival camp, but the zombie theme is used to make it more fun and help attendees better prepare for life's unexpected events like Superstorm Sandy, a car accident, or, you know, maybe a flesh-eating monster. That'll do it for this hour. For Gordon Deal and Jennifer Kashenka, I'm Mike Gavin. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News.
Hey, thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more from This Morning Show, check us out at thismorningwithgordondeal.com.